From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with writer Kate Simon. Her books on travel are among the most highly regarded in the genre, and her two memoirs about coming of age in the New York City of the 20s and 30s were published to lavish praise. Also today, I talk with actress Zelda Rubinstein. The 4'3" actress looked otherworldly in her role as the clairvoyant in Poltergeist. She stars in the new horror film, Anguish. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the career of pianist Paul Bley. And television critic David Bianculli previews the 20th anniversary reunion of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. When Kate Simon was growing up, in the years after the First World War, her world was her neighborhood in the Bronx, where most of the adults were immigrants like her parents. The movies gave her dreams of another world of glamour and adventure. She later was given a pass to see the world when she became a travel writer. Simon wrote books about New York, Mexico, Italy, Paris, and London. The distance she had traveled was more than geographical. Simon was the first person in her family to graduate from high school. When she got older, Simon thought back to her childhood and began writing a series of memoirs. Two of those books have already been published, Bronx Primitive and A Wider World. She's working on a third. Her new book is a history of the Renaissance. It covers the art, magic, science, plagues, and sexual practices of that time. It's titled A Renaissance Tapestry. I spoke with Kate Simon from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked her if writing about travel got her interested in writing about history.
Oh, always. Each travel book was something like a graduate course, and each book was the diploma, the degree, that is, of the travel books. When I, for instance, lived in Paris, I learned a great deal about French history because it interested me and because it gave solidity and quality to the book I was writing, I hoped. And gave considerable meaning to the personalities that were mentioned in various places and streets and so on. And when I lived in Italy, of course, I had to know a great deal of Italian history, particularly since, for one thing, in Rome, I lived practically in the Forum, and there's no point in being in empty ruins unless you knew who inhabited them before they were ruins, and so on and so forth, so that each travel book had a great deal of history, and besides the fact that I felt I should know it, I wanted to.
Your new book is about the Gonzaga dynasty of Mantua. Why did you want to focus on them for this book?
Well, that came through another interest, and that was art. I discovered a great deal of art I didn't know with each book. And in the course of writing Italy, The Places in Between, which is a book that covers many, many small cities, I came across Mantua, not the most beautiful, not the most attractive city, but centered around an immense, a vast looted palace in which I found some murals that had not been ruined yet. And one mural showed a family, vibrant, alive, not flatteringly painted, doing things. They were almost speaking to me. A painting of the Gonzaga done by Mantegna in the middle of the 15th century. And I looked at this, and as I said, they were speaking to me. And so I went to the archives. I went to the library. I went to other libraries. It was a good excuse for going back to Italy all the time and learned what I could about them. And then I became interested in the period and the people of the periods in which they functioned, the artists, the architects, the thinkers, the writers, the guests, the people to whom they were patrons. And that's what makes the book a Renaissance tapestry rather than just straight biography of the family, of the dynasty.
One of the things that interests me about this period is that it's the period when the plague ravaged Europe. And you actually write about different cults that developed around the plague, cults of celibacy, cults of excess, of sexual excess. Could you describe a couple of these?
Yes, they were not exactly cults, although you might call them that, but they were ways of making some philosophic peace with the fact that you were shortly to die. Now, Boccaccio's Decameron shows one level of cure or escape. That is, stories told in a very beautiful setting in the country with lots of dancing and lots of sexing. And then in other periods of plague, when we talk about plague, we talk about almost a continuous series, starting with the Great Plague of 1342. But at some later time in Italy, it was decided that homosexuality was okay. The church okayed it because that was a pleasure, that was a denial of death. Then there were groups that made it almost a rule that sex and love of all kinds and general amorousness and even pornography, which was, by the way, conspicuous part of the Renaissance, were helpful, at least. So I can't say it was cults, but it was modes of thinking in order to escape the plague or escape the meaning of the plague. And then there were all kinds of cures, which were pagan rather than Christian. Drinking your own urine was supposed to have been a way of curing the plague or making an ointment of it. And at one point, apples became very expensive because smelling apples was considered a very good thing. Or standing in front of a tannery and taking in the odors that came from the hides. There were all sorts of acts purely of desperation. And then there were political acts. For instance, when a city, a major city and a busy one like Venice, for instance, lost half to two-thirds of its people, it dropped its laws and imported Germans and gave them citizenship, which would not have happened had it not been for the plague.
Now, you're writing about a very wealthy family, the Gonzaga dynasty. How did the wealthy try to escape from the plague?
Well, they didn't always. They did have a good number of country houses in which they hid. But hide as you might, the plague very often got you. Some of them did escape the plague, of course, but one very important statesman among the Gonzaga, in his country estate, well surrounded by people he trusted, etc., who he thought was disease-free, did die of the plague. No one was absolutely safe.
You know, you've described Mantua as one of the places in between, that being not one of the showcase places, and not Venice or Rome, but a place that's really worth stopping at, and it will probably be a place you stop at between the major places. You have a book called Italy, the Places in Between, which is one of your travel books.
Right.
And I want to talk with you a little bit about some of the travel writing that you've done. Mm-hmm. In that book, The Places in Between, you write that the informed visitor will not allow himself to be cowed by the deluge of art. And you suggest that someone sees what interests and attracts them. And you say that there is not an Italian Secret Service that reports on whether you have seen everything, and that if you try to see it all, you may come to resist it all. And I think that you're addressing there a very common problem that the traveler has, which is you're here, you might not be here again, and you want to see everything, but you can't.
Well, I think the sentences you read say it, but it is very, very hard on a short-term visitor. That is, the visitor who has, let's say, 5 days for Tuscany. He has to see everything in Siena, which has wonderful, wonderful painting. He has to see Florence, which is not a very attractive city as city, but a conglomerate of incredible museums. He has to see what there is of Piero della Francesca. And all of this makes him very nervous, very restless, very dissatisfied. He should go slowly, pick out from a picture book maybe that which he must see in reality, and let it go at that.
During the years that you were traveling regularly and writing travel books, did you frequently travel alone?
Very often.
Were there things that you had to be aware of as a woman traveling alone through Europe and Mexico?
Well, in my time in Italy and France, there was no difficulty about walking alone at night, going to a restaurant alone at night, being alone at any time, actually. Mexico was never easy. There were in Mexico City areas where one could go alone, which were areas that were heavily inhabited by tourists from various countries. But the Mexican man decides very often that a tourist lady is out for a little pleasure, which he's very eager to give her. And it can be from embarrassing to frightening. Now I understand, I haven't tried it in Rome recently, you cannot walk the streets of Rome alone as I used to after a concert, after the opera, at 11, 12 o'clock at night. It cannot be done anymore.
Did you develop standard ways of responding to men who assumed that your being alone was a sign that you were interested in them?
Did I develop ways of showing that I was interested in
them? No, that you were not interested. Oh. That their presumptions were wrong and that they should just, like, leave you alone.
Oh, yes. I learned very quickly in each language some very tough thing to say.
Such as?
As, well, in Italian, say vattene, which is like go to hell, you know. Or you go into a shop and sit down for a long, long, long cup of coffee, which diminishes the patience of the pursuer. Sometimes I just laughed. Italian men are very valiant about flirting until they're 180 years old. And to turn around and laugh at an old, a courageous and optimistic but very funny old man discourages him quite well, quite thoroughly.
You know, I think some people are so used to company that they really have to learn how to enjoy themselves when they're on their own. Did you have to learn how to do that, or did that come naturally to you?
Well, it came almost naturally because I was not alone. That sounds rather odd. When you are living in a city and studying it, and going to the markets and going to the shops and watching the people on the street and observing the styles and learning the language, you are constantly in company.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt alone. I missed people, of course. And I used to come back for a month of friends in America. But I rarely, rarely felt alone. I was interested in what I was doing, and it meant something, and it was full of people and sounds and smells and sights which were with me.
When you started writing about travel, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do different from the way travel books had been written?
Yes. Travel books that I knew, with a very few and very good exceptions, like D.H. Lawrence, who wasn't considered a travel writer but was a great travel writer, most of them were just guidebooks, you know, listings. My New York book, for instance, is one of the first that was not like a telephone directory. And I was perfectly willing, rather eager, to be prejudiced and to express prejudice. This I do not like, that I like very much. Criticize, enhance, allure, seduce, demolish, anything you like, but they were personal books, as opposed to many others, and many others being done now, which are very good as practical guides, but mine are not what you would call practical guides. They try to explore people. They try to explore art, history. I'm an amateur sociologist. I'm an amateur architect. I'm an amateur city planner. And that all goes into the book.
I want to talk with you more about your travel writing and about your life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Kate Simon. She's a travel writer who also wrote two acclaimed memoirs. Her new book is about the Renaissance. It's called A Renaissance Tapestry, The Gonzaga of Mantua. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Travel writer, historian, and memoirist Kate Simon is my guest. You know, you've described so many places in the world so well. A few years ago, you turned to describing your own life in a series of memoirs that you're still working on. Can I ask you to describe the neighborhood that you grew up in?
Yes. It was in the Bronx, then called the North Bronx, because it was north of Tremont Avenue. The Bronx is now, as you know, all South Bronx. No one makes distinctions. But this was a neighborhood north of Crotona Park, and Crotona Park was our summer camp, our Eden, our exploring grounds, our fresh air, our trees, our flowers places. And it was a mixed neighborhood, extraordinarily interesting and very valuable in later learnings for me. About one side of the street, of our particular street, was Italian, southern Italian uptown, downtown, northern Italian uptown. Across the street from those small houses were tenements, which were inhabited by Jews, Germans, Romanians, Hungarians, Polish people. We even had a Chinese laundryman. We had no black people at all that I can remember. And the paste that held all these people together was the needs and the fears of immigrants. They came to each other when they were afraid of people who spoke perfect English. That was them. That was like the enemy, the school nurse, the truant officer, the rather frightening policeman, people from immigration. So that we did have a sense, no matter where we came from and what our language was, of interdependence. My mother, for instance, took care of little Italian babies in convulsions. The Italians who fought with each other, the southern against the northern, and that, by the way, is where I learned some very colorful Italian, used to come to the Jewish families rather than to each other.
Now, I'll bet that you knew very few women who were professionals outside of your teachers. It's always interesting to me when someone grows up in an environment where few women work and then becomes a working person themselves.
Well, my mother had been a working woman. My mother, on 1 year of schooling, managed, by the way, to learn 3 or 4 languages reasonably well. But she had been apprenticed in a corset shop when she was 8 and learned all the skills she needed to open a shop when she was quite young. And it was a very successful shop in Warsaw. So she was a career woman in that sense and always wanted to go back to the career that she knew and did. When we were in school, she used to go from house to house selling services or corsets, I don't quite remember, and ultimately went back to having her own shop with employees. But she was the only one, other than teachers and librarians, both of whom I adored and who were a rare and wonderful race. I knew no other No other professional women.
Well, even when it was time for you to go to high school, your father insisted that you go to a commercial high school so that you can learn secretarial skills, figuring that that was the only job you'd ever be able to get.
That's right. The best you could do was file clerk, typing, maybe bookkeeping or shorthand. But those are rather high in that series of steps.
When you were coming of age, you write about this very colorfully in one of your memoirs, in your memoir, A Wider World. You really wanted a much more exciting life than the one you saw in your neighborhood, a more cosmopolitan life. And you started dressing in a very rebellious kind of way and behaving in a very rebellious kind of way. When you look back on that now, do you think of that as affectation? Are you embarrassed by any of that? Are you proud of it? Do you think of it as a necessary transition, something you had to go through to proclaim your independence?
I think that I was expressing what adolescents do now. They express it in much more dangerous ways very often. But I had to leave parental controls. I had to expand my horizons, and I had to try on various roles. The costume has become rather famous among my readers, the long coat and the borsalino hat and the black sneakers. But that was a role I tried on, and that suited me for a while. And then in college, later on, still in adolescence, I suppose, I tried on emotional and mental roles of being the wife of William Morris, for instance, or traveling with some great poet or great painter and being his helpmeet. And all of these are adolescent fantasies which have to be, in a way, tried on and discarded when one is ready to discard them. And one never really, really discards them. They're always lovely fantasies that one can look at with a smile, with a little bit of pleasure, not seriously, but a nice thing to own.
I really like the way you put that, because I think a lot of people look back on their teenage years and are slightly embarrassed about some of the roles that they tried on.
No, I'm not embarrassed. It was a great time, and
I
cherish it.
You know, one thing that really amazes me about your adolescence, as you were coming of age, you were very sexually free. I mean, you had your own inhibitions and everything, but you weren't going to let society's standards define what your behavior was going to be. And consequently, when you were a teenager, you got pregnant a couple of times, had a couple of abortions. It was incredibly dangerous to have abortions. And, I mean, truly, you could have been killed by them. I think a lot of women in your position would have chosen to have the baby not because they wanted to be a mother, but just because the risks, I mean, not necessarily because they wanted to be a mother, but because the risks of abortion were so great. I guess you were really firm on not wanting to be a parent at that age.
No, I knew that ultimately I would want to be a parent, but not then.
I meant not at that particular
then.
Age. Yeah.
I wasn't ready, very much not ready. And something, I think this is true of many adolescents, I was testing my courage. Many, many adolescents are a little afraid of what they are afraid of how afraid they must be or might be. And I kept pushing and meeting challenges in many ways, and one of them was the abortion. And also, it was not uncommon for girls to have abortions with illegal abortionists, some of whom maltreated them, some of them didn't. It was not one of those very rare experiences. We think of it as rare now that abortion is legal, but it was not. And then we had heard terrible stories from our mothers, our aunts, of self-aborting, of using dreadful instruments on themselves, or drinking what I would think of as poisonous or semi-poisonous medicines to induce abortion, so that when we went to something that acted like a doctor, we had difficulty with the money, but not so much with the fear of real danger.
You said you always knew you wanted to become a parent. Did you end up having children? I really don't know this about you.
Yes, I had a daughter who died.
Oh, Mary.
Ultimately.
I'm sorry.
Well, I'm sorry too, but it's all right.
You are continuing your series of memoirs now.
Yeah.
And at this point, you're writing about being a young adult. This is a book that hasn't been published yet.
No, it's in the writing.
Is this a harder period to write about? I think perhaps adulthood isn't as crystallized for us when we look back as childhood and adolescence is.
No, it isn't as crystallized, which is a good word. And also, when you write of your childhood and your adolescence, this is far away. The problems were not enormous. They seemed overwhelming at some points, at some times. But really, they were experiences in bizarre acts with bizarre people, learning judgments, trying to learn who you were, how much breath you could put into your life. Later on, you meet the realities of love, whatever that is, of mating, whatever that is, of relationships which are firm and meant to be firm and sometimes are very infirm. You meet disease, you meet death, you meet the death of friends, you meet the death of relatives. You are in another world, actually, from that rather bright, carefree world of childhood and adolescence, although it doesn't seem carefree at the moment. When you look back, it was carefree compared to adult experiences.
What are you doing to bring back memories, to give those blurry memories the detail with which you write about them?
Well, I write for a first draft very straight, as if it were a distant story. And then I go back and fill in details which may give me the heightened emotion, not give me, but give the words the heightened emotion they should have. I fill in, I delete. In other words, I purify in order to make what I hope will be both true and effective.
Well, I look forward to reading your new volume, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Travel writer and memoirist Kate Simon, her new book is about the Renaissance. It's titled A Renaissance Tapestry, The Gonzaga of Mantua. It's published by Harper & Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Richard Gilman. He's a drama critic, a professor at the Yale School of Drama, and author of the memoir Faith, Sex, and Mystery. It tells of his conversion from Judaism to Catholicism, which was followed by a gradual loss of faith. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with actress Zelda Rubinstein. The 4'3" actress started an acting troupe of little people to develop their skills away from Hollywood stereotypes. She played the clairvoyant in Poltergeist and now stars in the new horror film Anguish. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the career of pianist Paul Bley and says his skills are displayed to best effect in a new reissue of a 1964 session. And television critic David Bianculli previews the reunion of the cast from the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. It's been 20 years since CBS canceled the series over program content. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. Attorney General Edwin Meese today denied any wrongdoing in connection with a plan to head off Israeli interference with a proposed Iraqi oil pipeline. Special Prosecutor James McKay is investigating whether Meese knew about an alleged scheme to bribe an Israeli official to get their support for the project. In a prepared statement, Meese admitted discussing the subject with Israeli leaders, but he said the talks were not detailed.
There were only two contacts, both of which occurred in the fall of 1985. Each was brief and limited, and neither was initiated by me. I can't go into detail regarding these contacts because of current security classifications, but I can say that at no time was there any discussion, hint, or implication of a payment to any official or political party.
The pipeline investigation centers on a memo to me sent by close friend E. Robert Wallach. The memo reportedly outlined the bribery scheme. Wallach had a financial interest in the pipeline, which was never built. The Soviet Foreign Ministry said today Secretary of State George Shultz will meet in Moscow this month for visits with Foreign Minister Edvard Shevardnadze. The session will be the first in a series of monthly meetings to prepare for an expected summit between President Reagan and General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev. Republican Senator Jesse Helms today continued his attack on the U.S.-Soviet medium-range missile treaty. He told fellow members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that the treaty leaves Europe vulnerable to Soviet aggression.
The Soviets are confident that we will not risk this planet just to put an end to what some are likely to describe it in that event as just some unpleasant Soviet aggression in Europe.
Helms was challenged by Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci, who warned that rejection of the treaty could result in the removal of American nuclear missiles from Europe anyway. Carlucci testified also before the committee. The fight over President Reagan's proposed Contra aid package intensified today. In a speech to national religious broadcasters, Mr. Reagan portrayed the $36 million proposal as the last chance to make the Sandinista government comply with the Central American peace plan. Steep price increases went into effect today in Poland under a new government austerity program. Food costs rose an average of 40%, while fuel prices jumped as much as 100%. There were no reported protests today, although thousands demonstrated against the price hikes over the weekend. In Warsaw today, police broke up an unrelated demonstration at the Romanian embassy. The protest was part of a coordinated campaign in several East Bloc countries. The BBC's Martin Sixsmith explains.
The demonstration had been well publicized in opposition circles here, and the Romanian embassy was sealed off from early morning by large numbers of uniformed police. Nonetheless, demonstrators gathered in a nearby street, and two groups of them managed to push past the police and run towards the embassy. About 20 protesters were eventually seized, their banners were torn from them, and they were dragged to waiting police vans, struggling and shouting, "Europe is watching us." A statement from the banned Polish Socialist Party, which helped to organize the demonstration, said they were protesting in support of the struggle for basic human rights and political freedom in Romania. The demonstration was part of a coordinated campaign by East European dissident groups, and similar events were also planned in Czechoslovakia and in Hungary, the first time that opposition groups in the communist bloc have coordinated their protests on such a large scale.
Martin Sixsmith reporting from Warsaw. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 13 points to close at 1944.63. Advances led declines in heavy trading of 212 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 17 cents. I'm Sharon Green, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz pianist and composer Paul Bley recorded his first session in 1953 with bass player Charles Mingus as a sideman. 5 years later, Bley worked in Los Angeles with saxophonist Ornette Coleman. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Bley is still going strong, but a new reissue of a 1964 session is among his best records.
Years ago, Paul Bley was the first pianist to come to terms with Ornette Coleman's new approach to improvising. Coleman had rejected the idea of playing solos over a recurring series of chords, the very chords jazz pianists were usually expected to spell out, which is why Coleman has almost never worked with a piano player. But by the early 60s, Paul Bley had devised a lean and linear style more melodically than harmonically oriented. Like Coleman, he'd let an improvisation on a theme grow organically, without worrying about how many bars long it was or what key it was in. His music breathes. In the early 60s, when pianists McCoy Tyner and Cecil Taylor set the style with huge, imposing sounds, Bley went against the grain. Listen to him on a 1964 quartet performance of Carla Bley's tune, Calls. Comes from one of Bley's finest sessions by a band captured in the studio exactly once. The music they'd recorded for Savoy in 1964 went unreleased for 11 years until Bley issued most of it on Turning Point, an LP on his own improvising artist label, which made him one of the few musicians ever to bootleg his own record. The complete 1964 session can now be heard on a Savoy jazz album, Turns. Bassist Gary Peacock and drummer Paul Motion were at the time Bley's regular rhythm team, and like him, were busily redefining their functions. In those days of musical and social revolution, rhythm players were temporarily liberated from the chore of keeping time for the rest of the group. Peacock and Motion didn't so much mark off the beat as they did circle around it. On this date, as usual, Bley played tunes by his then-wife, Carla Bley, who at this early stage in her composing career indulged in what we might call comic minimalism. Here's a Haywire Waltz she wrote, Turns. If Peacock and Motion were used to the Bley's thorny music, tenor saxophonist John Gilmore was not. Since the mid-50s, he's been closely associated with the visionary big band leader Sun Ra, from whom he was then on leave. Used to the busier setting of Ra's orchestra, Gilmore sounds disoriented in a positive way. His hesitant quality complements Paul Bley's reticence. But he also adds a note of urgency and earthy contrast. In Gilmour's solo on Turns, you can hear the incantatory quality John Coltrane admired in his work. Coalition was a fragile one, and it soon spun apart. John Gilmour returned to Sun Ra's employ, where he remains. Gary Peacock and Paul Motion moved on to other rhythm sections. Paul and Carla Bley split up, Carla going on to record a few splendid albums of her own, although lately she's been in a slump. Paul Bley continues to follow his own course, playing piano in the same aerated style that made him the avant-garde's odd man out 24 years ago.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed a reissue of a 1964 Paul Bley session on the Savoy label. The album is called Turns. This is Fresh Air. Zelda Rubinstein looked otherworldly in her role as the clairvoyant in the film Poltergeist. Her size, she's 4'3" tall, and her voice, high but authoritative, enhanced that image. She likes unusual roles, but hates those that perpetuate stereotypes of little people. Rubinstein didn't start acting until 1980, after a 20-year career as a blood bank lab technician. She's since been featured in Under the Rainbow, 16 Candles, and Francis. Now she's starring in the new horror film, Anguish. The film takes place in a movie theater as the audience watches a horror film about a killer controlled by his deranged mother.
Slowly, my baby. Deep, easy breaths. Let your mind float into space. Feel the power and flow. The blood is rushing from your heart to your head. Feel it. Your head is filling up with blood. God. Now the blood is flowing from your head back to your heart. Feel it. It makes you strong.
Did you take any pleasure in playing somebody pretty demented?
No, it was a big acting job for me. I tend to be a paragon of stability. But I did have to search pretty deeply under all the layers of sublimation to find that part of me which is truly evil. It was an experience uncovering this demented, bizarre, evil old lady.
I know that you're very concerned about the image of small people as represented in the parts that they take in movies. Did you have any concerns about playing somebody demented in a horror movie?
No, not at all. Not at all. This lady was, above all else, a mother. She felt, was unaware that she was really crazy. She didn't know how far off plumb she was. She was true to herself. She was not cast as a stereotypical character. Those are the things that bug me, and bug me terrifically.
What are the typical stereotypes that get written for small people for the for the roles that they get written?
They get written as costume critters, people in furry costumes. I'm not talking about those times that we need to anthropomorphize our fairy tales. I'm talking about being the butt of rude jokes and somebody else's idea of what a little person can accomplish as an actor.
When you got into acting, was it initially hard to get an agent because of your size and because of the possibility that there'd only be a limited number of roles available to you?
No. If anything, it was helpful because I'm an unusual-looking character. I'm emotionally endowed, verbally skillful, reasonably so. And I was working within 2 weeks of my initial entry.
Now, I think your first role was in Under the Rainbow, which was a movie about the reunion of the actors who played the Munchkins in The Wizard of Oz.
And other people. Yeah, it was a serious disappointment and a major lesson for me. I think the script was not as bad as the end result. The script really did not in any way indicate denigration of little people. The way it was edited made everybody seem as if they were a drunken, wild, orgiastic, almost toy. And I regret that the movie turned out that way. The part of me that was evil enough to create Alice Pressman in anguish is evil enough to make the editor a soprano if I catch him.
I want to ask you about The Wizard of Oz, since that relates to the movie Under the Rainbow. Did you see The Wizard of Oz when you were growing up, and what did you think of the Munchkin roles in it?
To this day, I have not seen The Wizard of Oz.
No kidding. You know, I'm really surprised to hear that. No child in America escapes without having seen The Wizard of Oz.
When I was a child, I was a very protected child. And I was already deep in my teens before I ever heard that back in the 30s, The Wizard of Oz had been made. I've just never seen it.
I'm not sure when this was, but I know there was a period when you organized and headed a repertory company called the Michael Dunn Memorial Repertory Company, and it was a company made up of actors who were all little people. Why did you want to do a company of little people?
I wanted to be able to train some little people to become the actors they wanted to be. I set this up as a very helpful thing for people who wanted to be mainstream actors. And we existed for 2 years in the conservatory mode, had the best possible teachers in all the disciplines. But the one thing that cannot be taught and is such an individual matter is putting down the script that says you're damaged goods. And it was very just difficult, nigh unto impossible, to invade people's psyche in that area. And the company kind of failed because there was an unwillingness to work.
Are you saying that the actors in the company had self-image problems that prevented them from really following through?
Yes.
Is that something that you tried to address with them?
Very much so. It's sometimes something I find occurs in many minority groups. Society is damn willing to disenfranchise a good bunch of its members. And, you got to take a stand somewhere. And just say, it's my world, too. And if you don't like the fact that I share the world with you, you get off.
It must have been hard for you to disband the company.
It was very painful. It was very painful to fail in a project that was so close and whose dream was so vivid in my eyes.
But I guess that gave you more time to invest in your own career.
It's true. That's true.
Now, I haven't seen any of this campaign, but I understand that you acted or spoken in a campaign of, I think, television public service spots for AIDS education. Could you describe the campaign that you've participated in?
Yes, it began in 1985. It was a California state-funded campaign for AIDS awareness, geared at that time to primarily the gay community. And I portrayed a spokes character called Mother. And Mother was a non-judgmental, non-threatening, all-too-human, loving character. And it was very helpful, I think. I did billboards and bus backs and posters all over, bar videos, a great deal of public speaking, and it was a very good campaign.
Well, I have to tell you that there's a bit of irony, I think, in you having portrayed this kind of warm, caring, open-minded mother in the AIDS campaign and now playing this demonic mother in the movie Anguish.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a mother is a mother. Alice Pressman wasn't totally an evil mother. She was a mother. She loved her son.
See, I love this about you. You're really into the character. I mean, you're really seeing the character through the character's eyes.
Yeah.
I guess that's what you have to do when you act.
Mm-hmm. You got it.
Zelda Rubinstein stars in the new movie Anguish. She'll perform in an upcoming production of The Cherry Orchard at the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, we're following the Attorney General's problems. Edwin Meese spoke out today on reports that he received a memo proposing a bribe of an Israeli leader or perhaps that leader's political party. Also, looking ahead to Super Tuesday, the big Southern regional primary, Cokie Roberts reports on politics in the South this year. Linda Wertheimer updates us on Iowa, where the caucuses take place at the end of this week. And also a report from Moscow by Ann Cooper on returning veterans of the war in Afghanistan. As they return to the Soviet Union, their complaints seem reminiscent of the complaints of Vietnam veterans in this country some years ago.
Thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the late 60s, Tom and Dick Smothers were the bad boys of television. Each week, their antics ruffled feathers at CBS. This week, the network is airing the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour 20th reunion special. Television critic David Bianculli has a review.
When I hear that theme, I think about my dad. He and I used to watch the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour together, and it probably helped keep us close when a lot of other families were drifting apart. The show was on during the hottest, toughest years of the 60s, 1967 to 69, and the Smothers Brothers were the first members of the anti-establishment to get a network TV show. They played great music, tried new things, fought with censors, and basically reflected an us-versus-them attitude. In 1969, them won. CBS canceled the Smothers Brothers, even though the show was a top 10 hit. This Wednesday night, CBS presents the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour 20th reunion special. It's a year premature, but so what? The good news is that Tom and Dick and the old gang are back, and they haven't exactly mellowed with age.
And you haven't done anything wrong. I want to tell you, I thought maybe you'd change a little bit. They're starting the show, and what do? You have not done one responsible thing tonight on this show. You have not acted as a responsible adult in a minute. You've done nothing that is responsible.
Right now, I am wearing a condom.
Actually, they get to say a lot more in 1988 than they ever could in 1968. But you wouldn't know that by watching the show. There's little basis for comparison. This 20th anniversary reunion doesn't go the easy route and pull out a lot of old clips. In fact, there are only 3 lengthy clips in the whole special. The rest are squeezed into a rapid-fire montage which speeds across the screen as the brothers sing, "Those Were the Days." But as was always true with these guys, it pays to listen carefully. The lyrics are rewritten for the occasion.
Once upon a time we were on TV. Every Sunday night we knocked them dead. We stirred up some trouble so they fired us. I guess it was something that we said. Those were the days, my friend. We thought they'd never end. We'd sing and dance forever and a day. Our show was much too hip, so we got censorship. Those were the days. Oh yes, those were the days.
This special basically proves that old dogs can do new tricks, or can adapt the old ones to new times. Steve Martin, who wrote for the old show, is here briefly. So are Bob Einstein. Remember his Officer Judy? And Lee French, who updates her Have a Little Tea with Goldie skit. And, of course, there's Pat Paulson, with another deadpan, dead-on political speech.
George Bush is kind of like Jerry Ford without the pizzazz. Dukakis, where'd he get that name? Out the bottom of an eye chart?
Finally, there's the music, which the Smothers Brothers always treated seriously. Glenn Campbell, Jennifer Warnes, John Hartford are all here, doing new as well as old material. And my favorite moment of the whole hour comes when Mason Williams, who co-wrote the special, takes center stage to play his most famous musical composition. Some moments of the special aren't so wonderful. The Goldie skit drags a bit, and the piece featuring Steve Martin doesn't quite work. But the brothers and most of their guests are at the top of their game, and they ought to make the reunion permanent. 20 years later, I'd still watch the Smothers Brothers every week. I bet my dad would, too.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
Those were the days, oh yes, those were the days. Hey!
Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Reno, a comic whose material is about sexual politics. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile the Buzzcocks, a British punk group that had more influence on the British punk scene than better-known bands like the Sex Pistols. And book critic John Leonard will review The Year of the Barricades, a journey through 1968, by the English journalist and historian David Coate. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Ruth Harold, Kathy Anderson, and Anita McGlynn. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.